No, we'll focus on the IFLA Special Interest Group on library publishing. So I'll just give the word to Anne Åkerson. Anne Åkerson is a real veteran in this field. She's a IFLA veteran, former chair of the professional committee, and a lot of other work in IFLA. But I think the most interesting is that she published with Jim a book in 1995 about electronic journals. So that's
a long time ago. All right. I learned after we started organizing this meeting that at SIG midterms and committee midterms, we're supposed to allocate a little time for a business meeting. So Lars very kindly gave me some time. I don't know if we'll need half an hour, but this is what we're going to run through during my time with you. So I want to tell you a little bit about, not so much about IFLA. I assume you all know what IFLA is. Lots of heads nodding, not every head nodding. But IFLA is the International Federation of Library Associations, and it calls itself the Global Voice of Libraries. At this point, IFLA has members, I'm trying to think, in over 150 countries of the world, and that may be a low number, but that's the last number I remember. So it's very comprehensive, and it includes many, many members who are library associations in different countries, also institutions, academic institutions, and so on. So IFLA is pretty big, as you can imagine, and it organizes itself into a governing board with about 18 people on it, and then the other structure is the committee structure. And there are, I think at this point, 44 different committees for representing different interests, and each committee can have a maximum of like 20 people. So some of the committees are things like library statistics, library theory and practice, art libraries, so on and so forth. There are 44 of these. There are also about 15 or 16 or 17 special interest groups, of which we are one. Yeah, every special interest group is sponsored by a committee. So the committee under which we rest very loosely, the Library Publishing SIG, is acquisition and collection development. I think when we were getting started, we said, who's willing to sponsor us? And they said, you know, we'll do it. So that's where we live right now. IFLA is going through a restructuring, which is supposed to be announced in August, this August at the World International Library meeting in Dublin. And we don't quite know what's going to happen with the structure. Will the committees stay the same? Will they be different? I think the SIGs will continue because they're actually the most interesting part of IFLA. They're usually groups that have self-started because there's a new hot issue going on. So there's right now, for instance, a SIG on digital humanities. There are SIGs on epidemics and health, on library, environment. That kind of thing. So the SIGs will stay. I just don't know how the whole structure will. None of us knows how that will look in come August. So as you know or have deduced, the annual meeting is every year in August. It meets in a different city every year. And these cities are the subject of much discussion in the governing board, as I learned on my three different terms on the board. Bids are sought from cities about 3 years in advance. And the questionnaire for submitting a bid is enormous. And the board has to read all these, and they're like pages and pages long, you know, to do with costs, to do with facilities. The ability of the place to accommodate a group of up to 4,000 registrants, it's a big conference, And the ability of the local committee to actually make all this happen. So we are set for August in Dublin, if all goes well. I'm wondering how many of you might be planning to attend IFLA in Dublin? I see quite a few hands. Yeah. And if you're not planning to do it, I suggest you think about it, because it really is a very fine city. I think it's sized perfectly for this size of conference. It's kind of like Oslo. You had an IFLA here some years back. It's easy to get around. It's friendly, and there's a lot to do. It's also very attractive. It's a very, very nice place. So at the upcoming, all the committees and all the SIGs have the opportunity to bid for a 2-hour program slot to be scheduled during the Congress. And this SIG bid for a slot. We have a 2-hour slot. 1.5 hours will be program. Half an hour will be a business meeting. Jane Buggle kindly offered to chair the program planning and committee and all of that stuff for Dublin. And I thought maybe Jane could say a few words about what our plans are and what the topic will be and all those good things.
Hi, everybody. So the meeting that we're having is going to be on the Monday. So I think that's the 17th of August. And the theme of the meeting is Library Publishing Catalyst for Change. And we're looking for just all the talks will be 8 minutes or under. So some of them would be like maybe a 3-minute talk with one slide. So they'll all be very brief, but all on that theme. So some of the ideas that we had were, things about sustainability of publishing programs, about kind of ethical and legal implications. But one that we were particularly interested in is how can we encourage and formalize the exchange of information, support and mentoring between colleagues in the Global North and in the Global South? So we'd really like to get some short presentations about kind of stimulating developments in the South. So, I hope you'll all come along. The call for papers is on the IFLA 2020 page, and you can send your abstracts to me by the 3rd of April.
So I think that's it.
Thank you. So we hope to have a really good program. Last year, we were in Athens, and we also had a similar program. And it was, we kind of deviated from the usual 4 20-minute papers and discussion. We had these 5 quite quick talks within an hour, and it really it was a hugely well-attended meeting of a couple hundred or more people, and the format was very, very effective. So I think, being a newer group and being a more lively group, we will have a newer kind and a more lively kind of session. So thank you, Jane, for doing that. I also mentioned yesterday that the special interest group is led, if led is a very loose term, by a volunteer steering or coordinating committee. I mentioned the people who are on it. Lars, of course, is one of them. Jane and Marie. Also, the co-convener with me is Reggie Raju from Cape Town University in South Africa. We have Katerina Shabayeva from Russia, Grace Liu from Canada, Fiona Bradley, and Heather Todd from Australia. I think, if anybody else wants to join us and serve, we would be very happy. The committees in IFLA, as opposed to the SIGs, they all have a defined structure. They have a chair, and they have a secretary, and they have an information coordinator. And it's all very, very structured, and there are elections for all of those things. The SIGs, for better or for worse, are very, very loose. And maybe it's for the better, because we can kind of do whatever we need to do as long as we are seen to be active. So we constituted ourselves into a kind of informal steering committee to keep on top of things and so on. So that's how it works. Each IFLA committee and each IFLA SIG is asked to produce deliverables, produce product, have outcomes. And these are called focus areas for us. The Library Publishing SIG came up with two focus areas in our steering committee meetings in Athens. And both of these are proceeding with some work, and I think we could use help. So let me tell you what they are. Reggie is very keen on curriculum. He's very keen on training materials and teaching, encouraging the Global South is a big passion of his, and Africa, in learning how to do library publishing. He was a fellow of the Library Publishing Coalition, which is based in the U.S. and is kind of the one organization in the world right now that is a membership organization of library publishers. Most of these are in North America, but I think the LPC is growing. And it's a very important partner for our IFLA SIG. Reggie, I think, was a fellow of the Library Publishing Coalition last year and is very, very much interested in the Library Publishing Coalition, which is a big initiative, the curriculum. So I had a message from Reggie this morning. He's been meeting with Melanie Schlosser, who is a coordinator for the Library Publishing Coalition. And they're talking about how to identify key parts of the Library Publishing Coalition, the Library Publishing Coalition's curriculum, which you can find online. It's a wonderful, amazing, huge product. How to identify parts of that that would be of highest value for IFLA countries, especially in the Global South, but not just. And once those are identified, to get them translated into the IFLA languages. So for us, this is a kind of two-year focus area. Hopefully before August, Reggie and a very small group he's working with will have done that kind of identification. If you'd like to help, send me a note. And then the following year, we will talk about how to embed it into other countries and other languages. So that's our one focus area. Our second focus area is to identify libraries and organizations in IFLA globally that are doing library publishing. And one way we do this, of course, is through participation in IFLA events such as this. But we thought we would like to have some kind of directory or database, and that we would like to model it on the Library Publishing Coalition's annual directory, which they have been producing for several years now, and it is quite an amazing, rich, wonderful document. So for the last couple of months, a very small group of us have been working with Jessica Kirshner, who's sitting back there, and I'm going to call on her in a minute, with Jessica to identify the elements of the LPC database that would be broadly applicable worldwide. The LPC database is very comprehensive in having many fields and, many points of information. We thought that might be a little bit too much for a number of countries where perhaps library publishing is starting or English is not, a primary language or so on. So, Jessica, can you come and tell us what we've been doing and how it's going to be that by summer we're going to have something to send out to the IFLA community?
Well, I am giving a lightning talk about this in a couple minutes, so I won't repeat too much. But as Anne said, we've been working to put together a shorter survey, identify questions that would be applicable to all members, not our robust survey that we have now, which is great, but quite lengthy. And we are working on getting that to the web developers, we can send that out so everyone can answer the short survey and then have the option to answer the longer survey as well if they would like. Anything else you want me to mention?
No, but she's the boss of this whole
thing. I am the chair of the directory committee for LPC, at least through the end of June. So, yeah.
So, I mean, we're very grateful to the Library Publishing Coalition for such an incredible partnership and array of resources that IFLA can benefit from. I'm imagining that if all goes well, sometime in the summer, we will be posting messages on IFLA-L and the LitePub mailing list and everywhere else saying, here's a short form survey to identify library publishing globally. And the questions will be, you know, fairly simple. And hopefully we will start getting a good turnout showing what's happening around the world in library publishing. So we're really excited about that as well. So where we could use help, we certainly could use help on both the focus group areas. If you're interested in serving with Reggie on the curriculum group to identify key curriculum enrichment areas for worldwide library publishing, let me know. I think right now there are only two or three people from our group working on that. And if you're interested in the directory part, also please be in touch. What we need now for the directory part, what we need next is some translators, because we want to translate the questionnaire into all of IFLA's 7 languages. So obviously it's already in English. That's the basic language. Grace Liu, who's on the committee with Jessica, me, and others, is Chinese, and she said she would be very happy and capable of translating into Chinese. So we've got Chinese covered. Ekaterina Shabaeva in Russia has said she would be glad to translate this into Russian. So that now covers 3 of IFLA's 7 languages, and we will need translators in Spanish, French, German, and Arabic. So if any of you have good skills and you feel like you could help with that, that would be fine. But there are other ways in which you can help on this group as well. So, you know, please consider being active. You don't have to be a member of IFLA to do this. You don't have to attend the Congress. You just, are interested in contributing to the global development of library publishing. The other thing we maybe could use a volunteer for, not this moment, but hosting the midterm in 2021. If, you know, we're not required to have a midterm every year, but we were very lucky that last year Jane and Marie stepped up and said, sure, we'll do Ireland and we'll get it done in 3 months, and they did. Lars was so challenged by this that he said, no problem, we'll do one in Norway in 2020. But we don't have any other volunteers lined up. So if this is something that interests you, you see what kind of an event it is. Both years we've had about 60 people issued a call for papers. We're very broadly accepting. We're happy to hear what anyone is doing. And it's not a huge commitment, but it is a commitment, no question about it. So if that kind of thing interests you, also please give a shout. I think we might need to, Ireland, Norway, it would be good if we could get to some other region of Europe or some other part of the world, but that's not necessary either. So think about that. Those are the topics I wanted to cover with all of us here today. Are there any questions or comments or other items? Lars is looking.
Yeah, did you say that you'll find the group on the
Yes, I should have said that. You see, the things we take for granted. But yes, there is the SIG has a website. It has a piece of the IFLA website. So if you go into a search engine and you type SIG Library Publishing, that's the one that comes up. There's a certain amount of information there. We've certainly got information about the Dublin midterm that we had, along with the recordings from that. Jane and Marie are trying to get some of the papers up online as text as well, so that's a work in progress. There's information there about this midterm. There's a link to the streaming, but I think that's going to become a YouTube link, right? You're going to send us a new link. So in both cases, in the cases of the Dublin meeting, we've got everything covered through the recordings. And in the case of this one, we'll also have everything covered through the YouTube site. Now, if you would like to gather up some of these papers and see if we can create some sort of a virtual published volume, that would be great. We could even combine the two together or something like that. So yes, there is a web space. Jane is going to be doing some of the information work on that space. We also, I would like to be able to record what people are facing, what people are doing. That can well be done on our list, which is called LibPub, L-I-B-P-U-B, at, is it IFLAServe? I forget, they just changed the address. I think it's IFLAServe.org or something. We can send that out. So there are about, I think, 80 or 90 people signed up to that, but we should have more. And there should be more activity. Right now, the activity on the listserv has been pretty limited. You know, I saw a good article, here's the link. Or remember to come to the midterm, here's the link. But if we could have something more interactive and lively, that would be great. We can send this out to all the registrants after, right? Yeah. I mean, right now, we have the Library Publishing Coalition as a kind of a huge gathering point based in North America. And I think the idea is to create also for the rest of the world and for libraries in the rest of the world a kind of gathering space for library publishers. So it takes all of us to make that happen. And I think it also, will benefit greatly from the collaboration and the relationship with the Library Publishing Coalition, which is a well-structured and highly productive organization. So we're very lucky to have that. Then I think that's it, Lars.
Thank you.
Then I'll just hand the microphone over to Gry Moxnes, who is going to chair the next session.
Okay, so the next session is Library Publishing, Collaboration and Networks. We are going to hear four different presentations for the next hour. And first one out is Emma Vestli and Helge Høyvik, both from Oslo Metropolitan University. Emma is an academic librarian at the University Library at Oslo Met, where she works with digital publishing. And Helge Høyvik is a professor of e-learning and digital documentalism at Oslo Metropolitan University. And Emma is going to present Nordic User and Development Network for edX Active Learning Libraries.
Yes, thank you. Can you hear me? Yeah. It's been very interesting so far. But we've heard a lot about how the library is a publisher for journals, ebooks, and articles. But I want to address how the libraries can contribute to publishing e-learning materials. And this, maybe some of you participated in the breakout session with the Bokskapet, the bookshelf. And you are maybe a little bit more prepared for this presentation than the others. But I want to show you some examples on how we are working on this today. here at the library, and on a local and a national level. So a couple of talking points. How the library is a central part on the institution's development on digital learning materials, and how we need to look at new ways of organizing to share and collaborate more to live up to the future demands on digitalization. So this is a quote from Dennis Hayes. He's the author behind the book The McDonaldization of Education. And this is something we have worked a lot with, or are working a lot with here at Oslo Met, with our collaboration with the faculty members in order to make digital material on our Open EdX platform. First of all, there's a very student system focus in the leadership at the universities today. They think that the system is the solution to the digitalization problems. But we think we need to look more at the learning process and how the learning actually is a big part of the digitalization. So we think that the learning happens between the teacher, the student, and the document. And in this perspective, the document is made up by digital text, video, audio, interactive assignments, articles, ebooks, and more. And for us, the teachers are, a matter of fact, the ones that are doing the job. They are the ones that are standing in front of the camera. They are making the digital text. They are doing the interactive assignments. And they are the ones that are meeting the students and presenting this in a flipped way in the classroom. And we, the library, are helping them out with giving them courses. We help them in the media production department. We're helping them with the repositories, the publishing platforms, and more. Actually, the teachers have to go through a 50-hour course before they can even start develop and publish at our Open EdX platform. And today we have more than 30 titles on our Open EdX platform and more to come. So I will show you one example. So this is a totally open course. You can enter without even registering or signing in. So this is in Norwegian, of course, but this is made by two of the faculty members at the health department or the health faculty here. It's a course about epilepsy. And we see that the feedback from this is that it's a lot of interest, not only by the students here at the library, the students here at the university, but also from health institutions, other universities, and also interest groups that want to use this in their teaching. And this is the result has actually been that they have been granted with a fair amount of money now to start developing a digital postgraduate course within this field, something we think is pretty cool. We're working closely with the teachers on an institutional level with development of e-learning material for single courses or actually on entire study programs. But we're also working on a national level. And at the moment, we're collaborating with the Arctic University. Was that correct? I'm sorry, you switched names, so it's quite difficult to remember. Because we wanted to collaborate with the radiography department there with making a common topic within this field. And it's actually both faculty members from both universities and librarians from both universities that are making this together. So we're collaborating on a digital learning material. And we also have a collaboration with Griffith University in Australia. So it's both national and international. But today, most e-learning is very locally oriented on just a single teacher's work or just a single topic. But we need to think bigger and we need to look at open access solutions to this. And I want to show you one example. This is from Norway, but I think you might can relate. So in Norway, we have 13 different universities that offers 57 different bachelor degrees in nursing. Within these degrees, there are approximately 15 to 25 different topics, courses. And this amounts to roughly 1,500 different topics within Norway. So you see that When the teachers here are starting to develop e-learning resources, we need to find ways to collaborate. Today, we are using LMS systems like Canvas, Blackboard, and more. And many of these are lock-in systems. So it's very difficult to share the resources and the information between universities and even between faculties. So we need to, and for the teachers, this is also a big change in the way they are teaching. So it's a big, they have to learn a lot. They have to go through many steps to be good at what they're doing. So I want to show you a little video from our green screen production. Some of you might see it today, actually, but on how this affects the faculty members. If it starts working then. You know what? It didn't work. No matter what. It's a virus. No, I'm just kidding. Coronavirus. But some of you tried it out today. You're actually like a weather reporter. You have to stand. You don't see your PowerPoint. You're standing in your PowerPoint. So it's kind, yeah, it's a new way of learning. And you have to do your presentation in maybe 3 minutes when you're used to have 45 minutes of lecturing. So it's a bit of a new way of thinking, teaching, yeah. But this, to sum it up, we have to think on new ways of organizing ourselves, especially in Norway. So the last year, me and Helge and Gabi, we went on a tour across Norway. We went to Tromsø, we went to Stavanger and to Gjøvik and Kristiansand, amongst others. And we wanted to look at how the universities and especially the university libraries are working with this today. And actually, on Wednesday, we had our first meeting for Nudge All. You have to read the title because it's so long, which Helge organized very neatly. And we had our first workshop with participants from 11 university libraries from Norway, which is very good. And this shows that it's a lot of engagement around this topic and how we have to collaborate more. And many librarians are also in charge of their own teaching. Perhaps many of you are having courses within, databases, searches, writing courses, for instance. And we see also that the librarians are eager to try new things to present their material. So this is from Startpakka, which I would say is the library's gift to students because there's a lot of information in this course. It's study techniques, how to prepare and write assignments. It's crash course in referencing. It's searches in databases and more. And this is a typical resource that many libraries could benefit. And it's a typical resource. I'm going to stop it because it's a little bit hard. Typical resource that could be shared and scaled up. And if we start sharing and scaling things up, we can start develop more. And this is our, what should we say, Hall of Fame. These are some of the faculty members that have produced and published learning material on our platform. We have to build this wall bigger now. But we see that the faculty members take a lot of pride in publishing, and they feel a lot of responsibility and ownership to the material. So even though we have to think nationally, we have to think locally as well, because we have to, the material is dynamic as well as the knowledge is dynamic. So we have to improve it. We have to revise it, and we have to make it bigger to update it actually. And this is something we have to do on a local level with the ones that have start publishing. So we need local ownership, and we need local knowledge on the technology. So we need local knowledge on the systems that we're using. For instance, OpenEdX, which is an open source solution that everyone can start using. And we need knowledge about how to transform the traditional way of teaching into a digital media. And also how to preserve this material in repositories and more. And here comes the libraries. Nudge All is all about networks. If we look at how many others are organizing their workforce today, it's about networks and how they are combining knowledge, background, and competence between fields. And this is something we also can benefit from. The libraries are, there are so many different fields and competence within the library. And if we start using this and collaborating more with the faculty members, we can really start developing and sharing our knowledge. So if we start making digital courses together, we can build up knowledge across different universities. And if we begin with the librarian's own material, for instance, if we should make a course in APA referencing or something like that, we can share and develop competence while we're actually creating a digital material. And this digital material can be used by everybody. It should be open. And it should be also possible to be revising and participating in the material. So when we think of this, and in the long run, I think we as a library, we're used to making things open. And this is a part of our culture and our inheritance, if we can say that. So this is something we have to think of and think big around. And I think this will also show how the role of the library are switching from a more service provider to actually become a development partner with the faculties on these types of digital material. So I don't know if this illustration is clear enough, but please ask me some questions and I will try to answer them. Yeah, thank you very much.
Thank you, Emma. So the next presentation we're going to hear is from Jessica Kirchner. Jessica is the Open Educational Resource Librarian at Virginia Commonwealth University. She is currently the Assistant Editor of the Journal of Librarianship and Scholarly Communication and Publishing and the Chair of the Library Publishing Coalition Directory Committee. So Jessica is presenting Building a Comprehensive Collection of Library Publishers.
Great, thank you. Can you hear me? So hi, I'm Jessica Kirchner. I'm based in Virginia in the U.S., but I'm here talking today about my work with the Library Publishing Coalition, which Anne mentioned earlier. I am chair of the directory committee. It's a volunteer position. Serving on the committee is the volunteer. I will be cycling off at the end of June, serving on the board actually for LPC. So I'll still be involved, but I'm excited to share with you all the work that we're doing with our directory. So some of you might have seen this before, others might be new. This is the Library Publishing Directory, our 2020 version, which just came out last month. It's an annual publication that provides basic information about library publishing programs, including the types of publications, their services, staffing, funding, etc. It's produced by the Library Publishing Coalition, and the survey and publication is overseen by the LPC Directory Committee, which, like I said, I'm chair of right now. But this is very important. I want to emphasize it. All are welcome to submit regardless of LPC membership. So the Library Publishing Coalition produces it through its volunteers, through funding, but anyone can submit, and we are welcoming to a global audience. So I encourage you all to submit in the future. The only criteria for inclusion is to meet the Library Publishing Coalition's definition of library publishing. Which I pulled out the relevant part, or the most important part, I should say. It's basically supporting the creation, dissemination, and curation of scholarly works. So the type of publications produced by higher education institutions or like those produced by higher education institutions. I will talk about this a little bit later, but we're not limited to higher education institutions. The more important is the type of publication that we produce. So, like, if we're not looking for a public library that helps someone self-publish, but if you help produce academic journals, et cetera, we would be happy to include you in the directory. Like I said, we're looking for global in scope. For the 2020 directory, we had 153 entries. You can see most of them are based in North America, and that's just based on the Library Publishing Coalition's membership, which is based in North America. It's a small organization. Those are the institutions they support. Also, we disseminate the survey through the library, the directory committee's listserv. So it's about figuring out which listservs get out, the listservs that we're most often members of are the ones that meet North American audiences. So we're hoping to expand that. And thanks to everyone who came to the focus session this morning, and we got some good ideas about how to expand beyond North America, which we're looking forward to. But you can see we have some other publications from around the world as well. We got submissions from 12 countries this year, including Australia, Brazil, Canada, Germany, India, Ireland, New Zealand, Nigeria, South Africa, and Ukraine. And also interesting, we got two non-English entries this year. So we're thinking about putting together a language policy. So for our next submission, you will likely see that. And we're hoping to let people submit in their native language with the caveat that also included translation for English, since that's our basis. And partnership with the IFLA SIG will help with that as well. So this is a sample entry in the print print version. It's from my home institution. Shout out to them. Thanks for supporting me coming here. But you can see this is kind of what the entries look like. It includes, like I said, it's pretty robust. Contact information, general program overview, in-depth view of library publishing activities. So everything you publish in the calendar year, we measure July to June. And then number more detailed open access, hybrid, and paid, which you don't see here because we only do open access at Virginia Commonwealth. Types of publications, partnerships, preservation services, et cetera. So what's changed? The first directory was released in 2014. We had 115 entries. Like I said, in 2020, we had 153. So the entries are growing. It's also important to know that these are not the same. So the 138 entries that we had last year were not necessarily part of the 153 that we had this year. Everyone is welcome to submit, but some people might choose not to submit one year or forget to submit the survey, et cetera. We also have a new survey collection system as of last year. We used to do it in a spreadsheet. Now everyone completes a SurveyMonkey, which is a lot easier for us putting the survey together. And it's also now available in PDF, EPUB, and a searchable online database. I shall also add that there's a print version. So if you go to the library publishing website, that's the directory URL, you can do an advanced search. This is what the listing of entries looked like, and you can actually search for 1 year if you wanted to do that. And this is the entry. So it's the same entry that you saw in print, but this is what it looks like in the digital version. So similar, but more made for the digital environment. At the same time, library publishing is growing. So more institutions are creating programs, more institution types. Like I said, our definition calls for college university libraries, but there are other types of institutions engaging in publishing too. There are new platforms emerging, new services and service models, more publication types, and other changes as well. So all these changes have going on. There wasn't an update to the directory data model since 2014. So last year we started looking at that. And we're trying to echo the changes in the library publishing landscape in the directory. And again, thank you to everyone who came to the focus group this morning. We explored that a little bit more, and we're looking to make that an ongoing change. So we're working on identifying gaps in our data, identifying new things that are emerging within library publishing, better capturing the relationship with those outside the library, so for publishing those with not within our institutions, and understanding the relationship between university presses, which, especially in the U.S., is kind of growing gray now. So the partnership with the SIG. So as Anne mentioned earlier, one of the focus areas for the Library Publishing SIG is to create this comprehensive community of library publishers. So we're working with the SIG to identify overlap between the LPC processes and the IFLA SIG's goals, making sure our scope data collection is the same, creating a smaller survey, which is what we talked about before, and this is going to capture the information especially that IFLA wants, and then develop a shared process for data collection. So far, we've had representatives at our directory committee meetings, and has been there as Grace Liu. We've identified a subset of questions for the shorter form, and we're working on creating that form. So looking forward, we're going to work with IFLASIG to translate. As Anne mentioned, we have a call for volunteers, so that may or may not happen for this year, because the survey comes out in July. So we need to have that done soon. IFLASIG is still working on how they want to share their version of the data. And like I said, updates to the data model is going to be ongoing. And look for our survey in July. So we send it out over listservs. We will try to make sure it reaches beyond North American audiences, and we would welcome anyone submitting to the directory. So thank you. This is the list of my other committee members. If you have any questions, feel free to let me know. Thanks.
Thank you, Jessica. The next presenter is Allison Laird. Ali comes from Penn State University Libraries in the U.S. She is chair of the Penn State Library Open Outreach Group, and she is also currently serves as the chair of the Professional Development Committee for the Library Publishing Coalition. So Ali is presenting Creating a Library Publisher Mentorship Program.
Thank you. Once again, dealing with the headset. good morning, or almost afternoon, everyone. So I'm Ali Laird, again, from Penn State University. So today I'm going to talk about creating a library mentorship program, library publisher mentorship program. And again, this is going to be in light of the Libraries Publishing Coalition. So you've already heard quite a bit about that between, you know, what Anne mentioned earlier and then Jessica's presentation right before mine. So the overview for this is going to be, I'm going to explain a little bit around the background, the kind of needs that really triggered the desire to create this mentorship program, specifically in the Libraries Publishing Coalition group, and then kind of what our professional development committee, because as was noted in my introduction, I am the chair of the professional development committee for the LPC, kind of what we went through in our process to create a mentorship program and what resources we used, what the structure of the program was based off of kind of the needs that we identified. And then how we got communication out to our group to let them know that this was something that we were going to, you know, start and what the program might look like. And then I'll briefly detail, you know, the program launch, how the pilot year, which ran through 2019. So I'll explain the timeline there, but 2019. And then now the changes that we've done for this 2020 year, because we're now in the second year of the mentorship program. And then I'll provide some closing thoughts. So things to keep in mind. If you're interested, or if, you know, the IFLA-SIG is interested in, you know, creating some type of mentorship program themselves or whatever other library publishing groups you are a part of. So about me, as I noted, I'm the voting member for Penn State University. So Penn State University pays a membership to be a part of the Libraries Publishing Coalition. And as part of that, we get to have a voting member for the different things that the LPC calls on members to vote for. I've been that since 2017 when I started at Penn State. I have been a member of the LPC Professional Development Committee starting in 2018. And then this year, the 2019 through June 2020, I'm the chair of the Professional Development Committee. As Jessica noted, she's also on that same rotation, and she's rotating off of her committee. I'm also rotating off of my committee, but both of us are rotating onto the board of the LPC come July 1st. So we're still very much going to be involved in all of these committees and the things that are happening with the LPC. So back in 2018 at the LPC Forum, right before and right when I was starting on the Professional Development Committee, we started having a lot of discussions in our community member meetings at the LPC Forum, which is our annual conference, talking about just the desire to want to continue to benchmark, to kind of share the different resources that our institutions have to really learn from other institutions, because there are many of us, as you saw in Jessica's slide, throughout North America that are doing library publishing. We don't always get the opportunity to really talk about the differences between our programs, the things that work, the things that haven't, you know, how we've managed to progress in our careers, et cetera, and progress our programs. So that really started in the 2018 forum as well as in the 2019 forum. It continued then. So then we started having discussions once I started on the Professional Development Committee about ways we could, you know, kind of promote this benchmarking and ways that we could also help new members to the Libraries Publishing Coalition and folks who perhaps are new members at their institutions that are already a part of the LPC to feel more engaged and feel like they've got more connections to support them in their kind of professional development as well as their program development. So the thought that came up was a mentorship program. This would be a great way to kind of share our experiences with one another. So within our group, the Professional Development Committee, we came up with a decision to create and launch a program starting in 2019. So this was back in the second half of 2018, we were preparing this. So we reviewed as part of that the mentorship guidelines from a variety of different areas. So many of you know the Society for Scholarly Publishers, perhaps. They're a group that has their own sort of mentorship criteria within that society. So we were able to view those and we reviewed them. We also looked at the Association of University Presses, which I believe is a North American group for university press publishers. And they had a a conference mentorship group. So whenever you went to the conference, you were able to sign up to ask for a mentor who could discuss with you during that week's conference. So we looked at those guidelines. We looked at our own individual library mentorship programs, because many librarians who are on different faculty tracks within the U.S. will have a kind of mandatory mentor that they're able to meet with to kind of help them meet their faculty goals and whatnot. So we kind of took from very different various different places, looking at kind of what makes up a mentorship program, what the focuses of those programs are, as we were considering a mentorship program for library publishers. Then, of course, we established a timeline. Since we were in the end of 2018, we really wanted this to run throughout the calendar year versus the academic year. So we wanted to be able to have applications happen in January and then match up people by the end of January. That way the mentorship program could kind of run fairly, you know, in full swing throughout the year. And then end at the end of December, with our LPC forum happening in May every year is kind of a fairly close midpoint, though it's still in the first half of the year, which would allow for an opportunity if people participating in the mentorship program were able to make it to that conference to actually meet their mentor or mentee in person and kind of have discussion. So as we were preparing this and we were looking at the structure of the program, we really wanted to identify some goals that we could clearly, you know, share out with the community as they were considering being a part of this mentorship program. So primarily we wanted it to enrich participants' experiences within the library's publishing coalition, and also to build relationships between peers, because we felt that those were kind of the strongest needs. But secondarily, we wanted to make sure that we were also highlighting the fact that we wanted this to further the development of library publishing through professional and a semi-structured mentorship program. So also, you know, helping you to develop your own library publishing and also your own professional library publishing career. So we pulled together an application form with some basic information, you know, your name, institution, whether you wanted to be a mentor or a mentee, and perhaps what goals you had for the program, what you were hoping to get out of it. And as well as your professional background to kind of help us get a little bit of a sense of kind of who has expertise in what areas as we were looking at matching up those that had applied. We also pulled together a list of 10 guidelines so that we were able to establish some ground rules and expectations. These don't have to be, you know, the same for everyone, for every mentorship program. But here's a list of some of the ones that we pulled together. Mostly we were just trying to make sure that nobody was coming into this program hoping to get something that is kind of unrealistic. You know, we wanted to set clear expectations. So in the beginning, we asked that you be clear about what you can and can't do for one another. Don't agree to things you can't commit. Seems fairly, you know, common sense, but it's also good to just outline those that we can point to in case something were to come up. You know, being a good listener, being approachable, taking a positive attitude, and then not being afraid to refer, you know, your mentor, mentee to someone else who has more expertise, because really that is one of the goals, is to create those relationships. So if you don't have the expertise, but you know someone else who does, that's also fulfilling the goal of the mentorship program by being able to refer someone out. And then, of course, having fun and being open to learning as we are getting to know our peers and learning from one another. So we launched the program in the very end of 2018. We started our communications. So how we did this was we had a community call for participants, asking for people to submit applications, letting them know when the application would be open. So we held this community call via Zoom, video conferencing. At the end of 2018, we kind of went through a short PowerPoint presentation, much of the information that I just shared with you, an overview of what we were hoping for the program. We asked for, you know, feedback, comments, thoughts, questions, if it wasn't clear. We didn't have the largest group of people come to that because people were still trying to figure it out, but I think we had about 20 or 25 that joined that were interested, trying to gather some more information. And interestingly enough, not everyone that joined the call applied, which is understandable, but some applied to the program that didn't, you know, participate in the call, which I also attribute to the fact that we sent out lots of email communication through our LPC listserv, and we were really... we promoted the application as well on the LPC website whenever we were preparing to receive applicants. Whenever the applications were submitted, they were done so through a Google form, which made it very easy for us to download a spreadsheet of that, kind of look at all the criteria and be able to match folks together based on, again, their background expertise and what their goals and hopes were out of the program. In the pilot year of 2019, when we had a focus on a mentor-mentee relationship, we had to recruit a few mentors because, not shockingly to me, many people feel that they always have something to learn versus feeling that they are an expert, perhaps, in their area or in a certain area. So we had to reach out to a couple of people and ask if they wouldn't mind serving as a mentor. Thankfully, many people were. Almost, I think everyone that we reached out to was extremely positive and said, sure, I would absolutely love to be a mentor. And, you know, obviously many of them said with the caveat that I'm not the be-all, end-all expert, which completely understandable. Everyone feels that way. But we managed to get enough people to match everybody up so nobody had to, you know, we didn't have to do any finagling of having, you know, a mentor having multiple mentees, et cetera. So that was fantastic. And then we sent out introduction emails to each of the pairs, CCing both of them on it, noting who their pair was, giving them some get-to-know-you questions, providing them with those guidelines that I shared so that, again, they both have it at the same time and are able to, you know, talk about those things in their first meeting if they find those appropriate. So again, as I noted, in the pilot year, the mentors, mentees met on their own schedules. That was part of the guidelines, part of the introductory questions. Let's, you know, encourage them to chat about how often they want to meet, for how long, you know, whether email communication was better than, you know, a Zoom or video communication or a phone call, et cetera. Once we kind of gave them the guidelines and provided the mentors and mentees, the participants with those that information, we really had little oversight. We didn't want to be imposing. We really wanted this to be a community-led mentorship program. We did send some occasional check-ins throughout the year, make sure that there were no, you know, issues or problems, make sure that there was no one who was feeling dissatisfied with the fact that perhaps they were not getting met with or people were lackluster. We did have guidelines as well for if there were perhaps any conflicts or any issues, how they could get in contact with the Professional Development Committee so that we could help them. We did not have any of those, thankfully, and all of the feedback has been positive, but we did want to make sure we had those things in place as well, just in case. The in-person meeting opportunity that I mentioned that happened in May at the library's publishing forum went fantastic. We had a group that met together over lunch, and funnily enough, not well, understandably, not all of the mentors and mentees were both able to make it to the forum, but we had a fantastic conversation with many mentees and mentors who perhaps didn't have their partner with them, but were able to chat with others and ask about how their mentorship relationship was going, get some tips perhaps on different questions or things that they were able to share that might be useful in their meetings with their you know, their partner as well. So that was a great time of feedback and discussion. And at the end of 2019, this past December, we had a wrap-up discussion as well as an open community call. So it was kind of twofold, where we had the participants from 2019 discuss how they felt that the program went and give any feedback and answer questions from those that perhaps were interested in joining but did not join or did not participate in 2019 to kind of drum up some more support and some more interest for the second year. So looking ahead in this 2020 program, we felt from the feedback that there was a desired focus more on peer mentorship rather than that mentor-mentee structure. Because as I said, whenever we were recruiting people for the first year, many wanted to sign up as a mentee versus a mentor. And many of the people who signed up as a mentee have been doing this library publishing, you know, for 3, 4, 5, 6 years, which many of us, you know, in that area would feel that that would be a veteran in some ways versus someone who had just, you know, was in their first year of starting. So we really focused on the fact that everyone has something to share with everyone else, and that that's a big focus of this program. So we rebranded it as peer mentorship. We got more participants in the second year as well, which was also very fantastic. Again, that's something you normally see whenever you have folks that can actually give personal experience and personal comments from it. So we didn't need to solicit any additional participants. It's still a fairly small group. I think we have 16 participants, 8 groups, which is also great, though, because that's still more than we had the first year. So again, we did a very similar timeline, sending them out the information. In May, we will have our library's publishing forum, and we are going to once again have an in-person meeting for that. So just a few closing thoughts, if, you know, in regards to creating a mentorship program. Some of the needs for doing that is really just a clear and established timeline, you know, good matching questions and criteria. We felt that asking for the goals from the program and asking for professional experience from those that were applying were extremely helpful in helping us to be able to match people up. And also reminders to keep, you know, good communication on time, because we really wanted to make sure that we were not too hands off, that it, you know, things potentially could trickle out and it didn't seem like there was enough support from the professional development committee. But again, wanting to make sure that that really this was led by the participants, that they felt like it was going to be meeting their needs. And then finally, just having strong guidelines and suggested questions, because those were the things that we received the strongest positive feedback on, the fact that there was actually a starting point for them to really get going. That way they felt that there was some structure and they weren't just kind of floundering around in the dark to get started. So that's all I have. Thank you very much, and I'll take questions later.
Thank you, Ali. So the last speakers of this session is Jane Bogle and Marie O'Neill. Jane Bogle is Deputy Librarian at Dublin Business School, Manager of DBS Library Press, Managing Editor of DBS Business Review. She is Chair of the Library Association of Ireland's Library Publishing Group, and in 2019 she co-chaired the IFLA SIG on library publishing in Dublin. Marie O'Neill is head of enhancement in CCT College in Dublin. She's also a council member of the Library Association of Ireland and the Library Publishing Group. And in 2019, she also co-chaired the IFLA SIG on library publishing in Dublin. So, Jane and Marie is presenting the Irish library publishing landscape 1 year on.
Event to date has been fantastic listening to all the presentations. Firstly, Jane and I just wanted to thank our respective institutions, Dublin Business School and also CCT College, for funding us to attend this wonderful event. Just a little bit of background on Jane and I. I've been in the library sector for 30 years and Jane likewise. And in the first half of our careers, we would have worked in the public library sector and the university library sector. And we then migrated in the second half of our careers into the private higher education sector in Ireland, which is a very developed section comprising colleges that have an umbrella group called HECA, the Higher Education Colleges Association. And we are both our respective institutions are members of this association. So what we really wanted to talk to you about today is how we've been involved in library publishing. And both of us in the latter half of our careers found ourselves working at Dublin Business School together. I was the head of library there, Jane was the deputy. We worked together for over a decade. And during that period, we established two peer-reviewed academic journals, one in business and one in arts. We got both of them indexed on the Directory of Open Access Journals. They were cross-institutional. We had advisory boards that were also cross-institutional, editorial boards which were cross-institutional. And we also became members of the Library Publishing Coalition. But we were doing this sort of in isolation, not realizing that there was this incredible, vibrant library community out there comprising all of you and many more. And this led us then to hosting the Library Publishing SIG in Dublin, and really sort of this has ignited, actually this meeting in Dublin has ignited the library publishing landscape in Ireland. It's really been that powerful. So we just want to talk to you about that. So just to give you the national position, in Ireland, the government has a document which is published, obviously, on open access, and it's called the National Principles for Open Access Policy Statement. And it states open access adds value to research, to the economy, and to society. The outputs from publicly funded research should be publicly available to researchers, but also to potential users in education, business, charitable, and public sectors, and to the general public. And I think that theme came through very strongly yesterday. There is also, we obviously work in the higher education sector. Both of us are in higher education institutions. And there is a national strategy for higher education to 2030 published by the Irish government. And it says we need to develop critical mass in our research capacity. And I think that's something that Lars mentioned, apologies, very powerfully yesterday, was the role of library publishing in terms of building the research capacity of institutions. And sometimes it can be a little daunting for Jane and I. We are from smaller private higher education institutions. Dublin Business School is just over 40 years old. CCT was established in 2005. We don't have, a 200-year-old pedigree. Our research cultures are developing rapidly, but they are very much in their infancy compared to a university that maybe is 200 years old. So for us, library publishing is extremely powerful in growing the research capacity of our respective institutions. So, what has happened 1 year on? Well, as I mentioned, we were publishing these journals. We were doing well with the publication of those journals and wonderful papers, wonderful submissions and so forth, and being on the DOAJ and all of that. And then there was the wonderful IFLA SIG. And suddenly we became aware of this incredible community of practice, of the IFLA SIG email list, of all of these library publishing programs around the world, and what we could learn from all these incredible library publishing programs around the world. And it was a really vibrant session. And then 1 month later, just to show you the power of the SIG, the president of the Library Association of Ireland, who was in attendance at the SIG in Dublin, we had sort of said we would like to set up a national library publishing group as part of the Library Association of Ireland. He was really impressed with what he saw at the IFLA SIG, and he was like, absolutely, definitely, Philip Cohen was the president at the time, and just to thank him for his support with that. I'm also a member of the Council of the Library Association of Ireland, on which Philip also sits, so I'm able to sort of feedback on developments directly to him. And then in September 2019, Jane, who had completed the library publishing curriculum, the LPC library publishing curriculum, embedded that curriculum within the MSc in Library and Information Studies at Dublin Business School. So in a very quick space of time, we went from sort of publishing in isolation to suddenly hosting the SIG, to establishing a national group with the support of the Library Association of Ireland, to now teaching the next generation of library students how to do library publishing, thanks to the wonderful work of the Library Publishing Coalition in relation to their curriculum. And that brought us very nicely to the IFLA SIG, where Anne and Lars very generously included myself and Jane on the organisation of this wonderful event, with lots more to come, because as Jane mentioned, Jane will be coordinating the call for papers for the event in Dublin in August, which we're really excited about. So I'll just hand you over to Jane.
So this is all of the material collated together, all the talks from the SIG last year. And then just to show you that what came out of that for us out of the SIG was that we could see that we could be part of a community of practice. And I know that Etienne Wegner has written kind of extensively on communities of practice. And one of the things that he said was, members of a community of practice are practitioners. They develop a shared repertoire of resources, experience, stories and tools. And I think that that is something that we have begun to do with you all. So there was some people published reviews of the SIG, and one of these reviews was by Suzanne Stapleton from the University of Florida. And she said the candid exchanges of successes and challenges at the meeting were informative and motivating, fueling improvements in library publishing around the globe, no doubt. So no less than that. And also a more local participant, Suzanne Redmond Malocco, said it was an insight into European and American collaborations on library publishing. Publishing, and definitely one that the Maynooth University, which was mentioned yesterday by Michael, will be supporting in the very near future. So, as Marie mentioned, we established the Library Association of Ireland Library Publishing Group, and we have met a number of times over the last few months, and we've developed our mission and vision. And the mission is to support and expand the library publishing culture in Ireland And our activities will include teaching, sharing best practice and fostering and developing networks and communities within Ireland and internationally. And our vision is to create an active and inclusive community of practice for library publishing in Ireland. So the groups, our membership so far has been within the higher education and university sector. But just to say to Goran and to Michael that we really want the public libraries to be involved as well. And we're open to participants from all kinds of different libraries. So at the moment we have representations from Trinity College, Maynooth University, our old institutions, and the Technical University of Dublin. And just to say that library publishing is really in its infancy in Ireland, and this will give you an example of some of the publications that are taking place. A lot of them are coming from the Technical University sector, and then we have our own DBS Business Review there.
Thank you. As Jane mentioned, a community of practice produces tools and resources. And already we've had a couple of meetings since we were established, and already we've been starting to look at platforms. Just in the last year alone, CCT College Dublin, where I work, has acquired Digital Commons, including the journal publishing platform. So I now want to go and set up a journal for CCT. And I'd just like to thank President Neil Gallagher of CCT, who's incredibly supportive in this respect. He's really a passionate advocate for research and professional development generally. Cork Institute of Technology in 2009 has just also bought Digital Commons too, and they are also very much looking at publishing journals. Dublin Business School, OJS is what we use there. And the Technological University Dublin that produces a lot of those academic journals, they publish them on Digital Commons. So already there's been a kind of an exponential growth in terms of just even the acquisition of platforms in the last 12 months. So again, we mentioned the national community of practice, and you have shared visions as a community of practice, values, tools, and at our last meeting, we had a strategy event, the Library Publishing Group of the Library Association of Ireland, and we have drafted a strategy for this group, which should be ready. We're still getting some feedback from some members, probably in the next month or two. In terms of shared values, that strategy, we identified the values of our group as being openness, access, creativity, innovation, equality, and inclusivity. I was really interested to hear inclusivity come up yesterday. Leadership, professionalism, and sustainability. And in terms of the tools, well, the library publishing curriculum we think is invaluable, and certainly we're going to encourage as many members as possible to do it. We have just established a WordPress site. It's very embryonic, but it's a start from little acorns, an email list, and we are going to establish a Twitter page. In terms of shared practices, you know, Ali and Jessica have highlighted the wonderful work of the Library Publishing Coalition, the IFLA Library Publishing SIG, invaluable to us. Digital Commons, COPE, all of these are invaluable tools. And these are some of our goals. I won't read out all of them, but obviously we want to raise awareness of this powerful role in libraries nationally, and to disseminate information as a group to libraries nationally and to library schools, and also to develop skills, knowledge sharing, events. We're already thinking about workshops that we're going to host nationally, and also community. We are a community, the Library Publishing Group in Ireland, but we are also raising awareness, and you will see many more of the members at events like this going forward. These are some testimonials. This is the Digital Scholarship Services Librarian at Cork Institute of Technology, Sinead Hanneran. And she has just been saying that they are developing their publishing offerings in that library in partnership with academic faculty, and that now the National Library Publishing Group has just sort of plugged her into this community of practice to help her develop this. This is Margaret Irons, who is the institutional librarian for the Institute of Celtic Studies. They are publishing a number of scholarly journals, and she feels that by now joining the National Publishing Group, she is more of an equal partner in this process going forward. I just want to read you this one. This is Niamh Brennan from Trinity College Dublin, who is a member of the group. She's Program Manager for Research Informatics at Trinity College. And we thought her testimonial was very powerful. She said, the LAI Library Publishing Group is a pioneering, much-needed initiative that acknowledges and supports the pivotal new role of librarians as publishers of academic journals and other high-quality research publications. As trusted practitioners in academia-led researcher-centric ethical and independent publishing, librarians are ideally placed to provide the platforms and apply the standards that comply with national and international open publishing policies while maximizing the impact of the published works. In turn, the librarian as publisher needs recognition and proper resourcing, as well as ongoing sharing of skills and expertise in order to build capacity and fully realize the potential of this group, which I think we can see happening with the efforts of Anne and Lars and many people in the SIG. The LAI Library Publishing Group is the ideal platform to support librarians to develop this exciting and transformative professional role. This is our website. It is very embryonic. We are just currently adding the biographies of members. We're going to put our strategy on there. We're going to highlight the IFLA SIG meetings and calls for papers. So we do feel it's going to be an important tool in terms of galvanizing, even just sort of collaboration with library publishing programs around the world. The Directory of Open Access Journals was mentioned. There are about 23 Irish open access journals published mostly by the universities in Ireland that are listed on this. And we know that maybe about a quarter of them have librarian involvement. And we felt that this is a kind of lost opportunity in a way. And we thought, how do we link up with those journals that are listed on that and become partners in the publication of these high quality open access peer-reviewed and journals. So we have, as a group, developed this concept called the IOAJ, which is obviously a pun on the DOAJ. It's not an index, but it's a coalition. And we want to establish a national coalition of open access publishers. Niamh Brennan at Trinity College is talking to various organizations in this respect as well. And that means that the IOAJ, members of that, who are publishing open access peer-reviewed journals, we'll work together with the LPC, apologies, with the Library Publishing Group, and we work together and say, let's work together. So it's one group working with another group to really sort of expand what we can do in the library publishing arena. We have had feedback from the DOAJ on it. They really, really like it. And they think that it can also help to promote more open access journals actually coming into the fold as well. By having this coalition of open access publishers at a national level, they can in turn encourage other open access publishers who are not yet on the DOAJ to join as well. So it's sort of a win-win for everyone. It's not established yet. It's being teased out. There's various bodies involved, but we think it's got a lot of promise. So hopefully watch this space. And also Plan S is a huge opportunity in Europe for us as library publishers, that we can go to academic institutions and we can say to academics, your publicly funded research, we have the skills to publish journals in partnership with you and some of this funded research. We can showcase this. I was very interested by what Anne had to say about the survey of the extent of library publishing activity, because two of our goals as a library publishing group, one is we want to do a national survey of what is happening in library publishing. We are discovering that there is little pockets of library publishing going on that nobody knew about, and we want to capture this. And also, we want to survey the Irish open access journals in the DOAJ to find out, well, how are librarians involved? And if they're not, why are they not involved? And marry the two pieces of data. But perhaps we'd be able to use the tool for the survey of the Irish publishers that Anne mentioned earlier. So I'll just hand over to James, who's going to talk about the curriculum. We're nearly there.
Hi. So I'm the subject leader on the MSc in Information and Library Management at Dublin Business School. And our program was coming up for programmatic review. And we decided to sort of bring it up to date by introducing an open librarianship module. So the components of that are open science, open source solutions within libraries, and then library publishing. So I've adapted the amazing curriculum and I'm now delivering that that. And the feedback from students, I'm not going to read that out, but it's been really positive. They weren't aware of this area and they're really excited about it. And they like the fact that the assignment that they were given was to develop a business plan for a library journal. And they felt that they learned a lot from that. Just it gave them an insight into the planning process themselves. So here we are in Oslo, and we're part of the dialogue again. We'll certainly be bringing a lot back to our group from what we've learned over the last few days, and also I'll be bringing it back to the students who I'll be teaching again next month. And so it's been a productive year. We have a national community of practice. We are expanding technical infrastructure, and we've started educating the next generation of library publishers. As I mentioned earlier with Anne, we have a call for papers out for the IFLA WLIC, and you can see the call there. And Marie?
And so just to say that we really feel that the community of practice that we were exposed to in Dublin really ignited all of this. And this shows the power of these events in terms of transforming the publishing landscape in nationally. But we have a little fun challenge. It is St. Patrick's Day on March the 17th. I'm on the marketing subcommittee for the World Library and Information Congress. And we thought that we would decide... We would have a little competition. So if you could tweet and use the World Library and Information Congress hashtag, which is hashtag WLIC2020. And if you could also include the hashtag for this event, hashtag LibPub2020. There are extra points if you use a shamrock emoji. And we would like, if you are coming to the Congress, we would like to know what it is you would like to see in Ireland. It doesn't have to be academic or a library. It could be something fun, but what maybe something touristic, what it is that you would like to experience when you're in Dublin or see. And the marketing subcommittee will pick the best tweet. And when you come to the Congress, you can collect your prize then, which is a beautiful book of Irish photography and a little shamrock pin as well. So you will be truly Irish while you're at the Congress. So maybe you might take a minute to do a fun tweet. So I'll just hand you back to Jane.
So I just want to say that we look forward to seeing many of you in Dublin, and to say that, as we say in the Irish language, Cead Míle Fáilte, that 100,000 welcomes await you. So again in Irish, Go to Míle Maith Agat. Thank you.
Thank you, Jane and Marie. It's almost lunchtime, but I think we will have a few minutes for questions. So if the presenters can join me.
I just had a comment for Ali that I signed up to be mentored this year. And I've been given the most amazing mentors, Sonia Betts, and she's from the University of Alberta. She's publishing like 60 journals and lots of open access materials, and she's great. So I'm a big fan.
Any other questions?
Thanks. In the library publishing directory, is there room for public libraries?
So I would say that there is, as long as they publish scholarly works. That seems to be the line that LPC is drawing. So like I said, no library is helping authors self-publish novels, but things of more academic fare definitely fit in. And institutions self-select. So at the beginning of the survey, we give you the definition, and you say, yes, I meet this definition, or no, I don't, and then you don't fill out the survey. So if you think you meet that definition, we welcome you, and we do have a couple of public, well, at least one Minitex, which is based in Minnesota and works with both public and academic institutions.
Thank you, Claire, and everything is very good and impressive, what you do. Anyway, I tried to challenge the very definition yesterday, but I don't know if it is possible. But anyway, I forgot to say that if you think that the definition is too narrow, then please, you as English-speaking, native English speakers, go to the Wikipedia and amend the definition.
Yeah, we did talk about that this morning at the focus group, and unfortunately, decisions like that are over my head. Like I said, I'm just a volunteer, but I think that what library publishing means is definitely different, and different to different people. And library publishing, the Library Publishing Coalition, might not be looking to collect all library publishing, but they're focused on academics. But I think they are trying to collect as much as possible. So.
So Nils Glallum from the Scandinavian University Press. It's a question for Oslo Met and Bokskapet. It was really interesting to both hear your presentation and to see how you work in the breakout session. It's obviously a great way to work with the students. I was looking at your web page and see that one of our books is literature that is recommended for the course as well. And the question is, how do you see textbooks in this environment of learning? How important is it from your view? And what kind of role will either like print textbooks or digital textbooks play in the future of learning?
Yeah.
Big question.
No. It's something we have thought a lot about. And we can see that this is just the bookshelf, or the course in the bookshelf is just one part of the documents that the students are reading and have on their literature list. And we see that the reading actually increases with the use of the digital material, because they use the videos for like an introduction, and then they go to class and talk about the topics, and then they go back to the books and read more and dig deeper. So we see that it's a collaboration between the digital material and the actual books. So we don't think it's either way.
Any more questions? No. Okay. Then I think I just want to thank all the speakers for really interesting presentations. And I think it's time for lunch.
Yeah. And let's start for the last part of the conference, the wrap-up, not panel discussion or debate, but more panel conversation, because it's not given that you are very... that you don't agree. That's what we're going to see. First of all, here is the participant list, some you can take with you afterwards. Marie O'Neill has replaced Anne.
Hmm? I'm Jane.
Yeah, sorry. Sorry. Jane has replaced Anne in the panel, and then we have Jesper Bosrup Testrup, which we heard yesterday from the Royal Danish Library, and we have Marte Eriksen Ryste from Cappelen Damm, private publisher, and Jan Erik Fransvåg from the University of Tromsø, the Norwegian Arctic University. Yeah. And Sue Ann Gardner from University of Nebraska. And most of them, almost all of them, belong to the library field, but not Marte. And I would like to start with you, Marte. You have been here 2 days, heard us discuss library publishing. Is that a threat to other publishing house? No, it's not on. Yeah, turn it on.
Okay, now? Yes. Okay, thank you. Yeah, I would like to start by thanking you for the invitation to participate on the conference and also in the panel, of course. But I think it's been two interesting days and also thought-provoking days. So, yeah, it's been great. And you also asked me in advance to prepare some thoughts to start off the panel session. Yeah. So, and I was thinking of that. Is this a threat to the publishers? I would like to start by giving some challenges, maybe back to you, because I think that it is interesting for us to see to ask the question: is it necessary for the libraries to become publishing organizations, and why? Would that be necessary for the libraries? I've been spending the last 3 years my education is in librarianship. I have a master in information science from Oslo Met, and I've been working in other publicly funded projects previously, where I've also been collaborating with libraries and librarians. So I'm not completely out of this sector or this audience. So I would like to point out that. And then back to track. I've been spending the last 3 years in a professional publishing house, building up the open access division of this publishing house together with a dedicated team and also the whole academic division of that publishing house. And I would say that the editorial work is the backbone of the publishing organization, and that the editorial work we are doing is the core competence also in the publishing house. And I don't think that that is skills that I learned in my library education. Nope. And I also think that there is no doubt that librarians can become editors and that you can make publishing houses in higher education institutions. There are a lot of successful examples of that. But that is, a library is not a publishing house per se, if you you get that. So I think if you would establish professional publishing services in a library or in a higher education institution, then you would need to... It is costly, depending on the ambitions you have for that service. So my question would be, and this is in a Norwegian context, my question would be, is this the right use of public resources to build professional publishing services in the libraries? And what would be the reasons to do that? Is it necessary to promote open access content or scholarly content, or are there other reasons for why the libraries want to do this? Yeah, you never gave me a time limit for my opening. So I don't know if you... I can continue, but maybe we should...
But that's a good question. And is it necessary for libraries to be publishers? Couldn't we stick to the core library activity? Libraries tend to always embrace new services, which is not... why should we publish? Jan Erik, you have been an advocate for open access almost as long as... Anne Åkerson. Why should library take up publication?
Well, I think that historically, higher education institutions have always been publishers. I did a report in the mid-90s on the publishing activities of my university and discovered that we had some 15, 20 different ISBN series allocated to us, in addition to a number of journals of some kind or other. So we were actually publishing a lot, but no one saw the university as a publisher. So yes, I think what you see today is a continuation of what we did. But when the question was, is this a threat to the commercial publishers? I'm afraid that my point of view is that the way we're doing it today, the publishing activities, the way we organize it, are more a threat to the economy of the institutions, because we do it so enormously inefficiently, costly and inefficiently. So and I have some bees in my bonnet, and one is that we need to do things on quite another scale in order to get the costs down. What I have heard today is a huge number of small initiatives, while what we need is a small number of huge initiatives. Then we could start talking, making sense of it.
Yeah, Sue, Marte says that publishing is costly. And you say that for $100,000 you can either publish 1,000 articles from the library or 25 articles into Elsevier journals.
Right. The way we're doing it, that's what it comes to cost. But your point is well taken, that depending on how you do it, it can be very expensive. And that's a conversation that we have in our library all the time is, what do we want to offer as services? What are we going to cut out? Because it's not going to be like a commercial publisher where you're offering every single thing. In fact, you're offering almost nothing, really. And like you're saying, in a way, I mean, we're doing editorial and production work. It's very bare bones, very basic. For some things, that's adequate. And it's the best way to do it, because why spend more than you need to on something very basic? The other thing that I think is important is the niche publishing aspect of what we do. We have published so many things that wouldn't be commercially viable, but have a small readership that really needs access to that information or that knowledge. And if we didn't do it, maybe that person would self-publish, or maybe you would pick it up. But we feel like we're filling a need, and that we can partner with things like what you're doing. And I also think that this is a conversation that's very important for us to have with commercial publishers, so that we can distinguish ourselves from what you're doing. We're not competing with each other. We're synergistically working together. So that's how I feel about the points you brought up. And let me look at my... the other thing is the IR, the institutional repository, how we think of it is we are publishers. And it's a set of services and infrastructure that is akin to commercial publishing. And the workflows are very similar from all of the different material types. To Lars's point, the library is a living organism. So that's something that I brought up yesterday, Ranganathan, number 5. And we're always offering new services. To remain viable, we must do that. And I think, you know, we have so many instances here that show that there's a place for what we're doing. Thank you.
Well, I would recognize your point as well. Our idea is not to press out private companies from the market. We chose to have as little service as possible on the server, which ended up being more than we expected. But we always tell them, if you want to have professional publish, you need to go to a private company. If you want to have help with your editorial workflow, finding reviews and all that, we have fine people that can do that, but we're not doing it. It comes as a shock for some of the editors, but we are really strict on that. Right now, we have this ebook platform, and we are discussing whether we want to expand it to other universities in Denmark. But the things that would be published there would not be things that you could sell. We make sure of that. Every time we stand with a title where we think, could this be made into a book that would be viable and could be sold, we say, are you sure you're not going need to talk with the publisher before you publish on our platform? So really try to have a strict line, because you publishers do a lot of things much better than you will ever be able to do, and much more efficient.
I'd just like to add one point, and that is that we are now educating librarians for these roles. You know, so things are moving on in that regard as well.
But when Marte says that publishing is costly, is the truth that quality costs money? And if Jesper says that, first ask a commercial publisher, and if you can't afford it, come to us. Is that a situation that libraries should take, that the quality is defined, the highest quality is defined with the private publishers, and we take all the rest? Or isn't it any differences?
Well, since most of the editorial boards do the review themselves anyway, I don't think the quality is an issue for the quality of the journals as such. The books that we publish are PhD theses and reports, and the quality there should be high enough anyway.
Yeah.
But still, you get them better things about design and public relation and things like that, and your marketing challenge that we can't.
Marta has views on that.
No, I would say for our open access books, we only publish scientific peer-reviewed content. So a lot of people think, okay, but the only one working on these books are the reviewers and the authors, and that's not true at all. Most of the books and most of the articles needs editorial work. They when an author has an idea for a book, we have a lot of researchers wants to make scientific anthologies, right? And we have a lot of work with the editors, coaching editors. What is the editorial role? What is expected? But also working on the abstracts before they start, because there are not always all projects are scientific in, yeah. So, and also working with the texts, etc. So, and of course there are books that come that are perfectly written and everything is just super streamlined, but most of the books we do editorial work, a lot of editorial work on them, even though they are scientific and there are peer reviewers, etc. So.
If I may, I think we need to distinguish between the quality of the content and the technical quality. And I think there's no reason to believe that the quality of the content is very much different between small-scale operations that we do and the more professional publishers. But the technical quality surrounding the content, the giving it distribution, making it look good, etc., they're in quite another division.
Yeah. But then, as we heard from Austria, a book published was sold in from 90 to 200 exemplars, and that's a typical scholarly book. So then, perhaps the technical quality isn't the most important, or.
Present making it into an efficient open access publication takes a lot of technical competence, and which we need to be big to in order to be able to build up that kind of competence, and the competence costs money, and that's a huge problem.
I would say too that one thing that we've done in Nebraska is hire a publisher and editor from the publishing world who were eager to do something new and have that public service ethic. And that's worked really well for us and them. They're able to focus on the things they love to do and at a high level. And perhaps they're frustrated in some ways with the fact that we can't be to scale or something, that we can't hire new people if we feel we need it. But there are limitations for sure. But we've been going since 2005, and I think that Paul Royster will retire with us, and so we have that quality because of them, and you can bring them in from the publishing world into the library. Plus, we can learn, like Jane is saying. I've learned everything that they do. I can't say I do it as well as them, but I'm incompetent to do, especially typesetting, I've learned how to do.
Yeah. Come on.
Well, no, I think even though the issue or we say that there should be no competition between the libraries and professional publishers, I think maybe there is. And if the libraries want to professionalize the way they work, there will be competition. So then we need to do the discussion with these questions. How much public money should we use on building that those services? Why are they needed? Is the professional publishers not doing a good enough job? I think also in my years working with open access in Kapellendam Akademisk, I have very little dialogue with the librarians. There are no librarians calling me to say, you are not doing this good enough, or we are not content with this, or there could be. I think the library sector is so important on pushing the open access agenda, but I don't feel that we have any cooperation or dialogue with the libraries, and so there feels like maybe there is some idea of competition that I would guess it would be a very good idea for the libraries to have an active dialogue with the publishers that are working on developing good open access services, because that is one of the aims of the whole discussion, promoting open access scholarly publishing.
But it's a pressure on the finances of the universities. We have to save money. The amount of publications increases. The story behind the open access movement was as a protest movement against the commercial monopolist publishers, often exemplified with Elsevier, who had big profits and so on. And I understand that it feels a little injustice to say that Kapellendam shall have to be in the same box as Elsevier. But it was a movement for non-profit publishing. And you might say that using public money to build university publishing houses is not right towards the private companies, but it's the university money used to buy books from private publishers also. So why shouldn't the university think we have to use, since it's our money, we have to use it as efficient as possible? Yeah. Any comments?
Well, the history of academic publishing originated in the academy, you know, and then I think the 1960s is when it really started to flip, and then through the 90s is when we got these astronomical prices, and it's been kind of sustained or higher even from there. You know, when you look at the history of academic publishing, what we're doing is kind of reclaiming some of that legacy and leveraging technology. I mean, it's kind of, we have connectivity, we have the infrastructure. It makes sense that this would be happening now.
But since you have the microphone, mm-hmm. As I mentioned, Elsevier as the company that had the big profits on scholarly publications. Elsevier have understood that the future is open access, so they plan on earning a lot of money on open access. And that's one of the reasons why they bought BPress.
Oh, yes.
And you're using BPress.
Yes, we are. Well, about 5 years ago, Paul and I would sit around and we'd say, Paul would say, I have nightmares sometimes that Elsevier is going to buy BPress, he would say. And I'd say, it could happen, you know. They're so well constructed. It's such a good system. It could happen. What are we going to do? We were strategizing. And then it happened, and I was expecting him to be all fired up, and he just was rather resigned. I was surprised. I guess he got it all out in his dreams. He worked it out. But what we did was we called up our friends at B Press, and we said, how are you doing? And they said this was a shock. We had no idea that we were going to be purchased. And we asked them, are you going to stay? What has happened? And they said, nothing has happened. It's the same. And we said, you have to tell us if it starts to become heavy-handed. You have to tell us if they start to get involved in your workflows, because we'll make decisions based on that. And we keep in touch with them, and they say that they're holding steady, and we don't see any evidence of them being involved in our own workflows, but we're paying attention to those things. And what I'm concerned about is, are they going to game the search engine optimization to preferentially make the results be Elsevier publications? And I haven't noticed that, but we're looking. And all I can say is we partner with lots of commercial entities. We use Microsoft products. We use Adobe products. Canvas. Anyway, just all of these things are phones. And does it obviate their usefulness? It's a matter of using them intentionally, knowing how they're impeding on your work, impeding your what you're trying to do. And you go from there. We have no plans to be Brexit. I think there's been one library maybe that has done that so far. Is that Penn State? No. Okay, no. Okay, sorry. I forget which one it was. And I know there's another. I can't say who. But we look around, and really, even though we're a larger university, it's cost effective for us. And just the idea of hiring someone to take care of a DSpace repository or some ePrints or something is cost prohibitive for us. And we've had a good relationship with the people at BPress, and so we're going to stay with them for now. And did I answer your question?
Yeah.
Thank you. You said we were from libraries, but I just want to make sure people know that I'm a librarian, but that's by accident. I'm an economist. And I'm not certain I agree with you that open access came as a result of profits, but some super profits that some of the publishers have. I don't think Universitetsforlagen or Kaplan Dam has any super profits, but it's also a movement to liberate the content, because knowledge should be freely available. That's the nature of knowledge. And I think that one of the problems we have is that we think that what we're doing at libraries is very cheap, and that's the only reason we can believe that is that because we have no idea what the costs really are, because our accounts are not geared to do that kind of analysis. Believe me, I've been working at the finance department of our university for many years, and I've been shocked at the level of economic competence out there. That doesn't mean we shouldn't do it, because we have a lot of journals and books that it's impossible to finance in a commercial market, and we finance it instead by abusing scholar time, taking them away from research. I'm not quite certain that's a good way of doing it, so we should finance it in some other way.
I think that the open access movement has been very successful, and I see the problem with the transition agreements and the big deals, etc. But in the freeing of content, and also in many, like in Norway, the movement have been successful in promoting open access publishing in many ways. And I don't think it's a good aim. If the aim is to get rid of the publishers, then I don't think that the researchers in the institutions or the students or society, I don't think that it is a wish to get rid of the academic professional publishers. I would also like to make a comment Oops, sorry. I have some notes. Because you say it's the university money, but it's public money.
It's public.
So then you have to decide how to use the public money in the best way, of course. And that is a debate not only for the libraries, but on a society level, of course. And I think it's important that we work on publishing models or financing models for open access, also because we see all those journals that are struggling to survive now because they are underfinanced. That's the problem. So I think we should work on models where they have the opportunity to apply for more funds, for models that can work where you put the journal and the authors in the center, where they get the power to apply for funds and also choose the services that they would like to use. I think that must be, that is in the context of the debate maybe in Norway, where we are discussing what kind of financing models should we have for open access content. So, yeah.
This discussion about financing models, is it the same in Denmark and in Ireland? You come from a private university.
We come from smaller colleges where we do a lot of it less. So we're not in receipt of public funding at all, but we sort of get on with things, prioritize things, and we don't have the same research culture as you're talking about in the universities where we're not doing PhDs, we're doing it to master's level. So it's a little bit different, but we just make do. We have no extra funding for this. We just get on with it.
I'm not really aware of the discussion in Denmark in that way. I know that every year we help journals apply for funding so that they can get money to get the extra services. And I think you're right. They are underfinanced. It's a big problem that very often is forgotten in the open access discussion. And very often we forget small publishers, compared to Elsevier in the discussion. And that I think you have a corner that needs to be covered somehow in the discussion.
Yeah, but back then to financing models, Diamond Open Access, which is without paying for reading or publishing, published by learned societies or libraries, or libraries on behalf of the university, private companies. Could we agree on one business model, or do we need to have more? That was a stupid question, because everybody can say, yes, we need to have more. Some comments on that?
Well,
I'll take over after you.
Yes, please do. I'm going to speak out of turn, but it seems to me that we need the private sector. They finance what we do, right? So it needs to be robust. It just has to be balanced. And I think I'll leave it at that because I'm not an economist.
Tone Strömmeback there and I authored an article a year ago on Plan S. And one of the things we found was that consistently, journals that had an APC-based model did better on the technical side than those who didn't. That means that the Diamond journals are consistently underfunded and not able to deliver technically on the same level as the more commercial models are. So that has nothing to do with profit. I mean, you can have APC and not be for profit, but it has to do with an APC could give you money enough to build up competence and deliver new things. And it also allows you to expand with the number of manuscripts, while a politically funded model that sets some limitations on what you can do and how much you can do.
But among the 100 open access journals in Norway, some few are using APCs. And I think we can agree upon that it's impossible to fund one of those journals only with APCs, that will be too costly for the authors. And for instance, for the journals published by the universities, well, we could start with a small APC payment, and then we'll get money from the University of Oslo and from Tromsø and so on, and Tromsø will get the APCs from us. It'll be just more bureaucracy.
Well, not if that means that they get more money into the system to the journals. Yeah. That's the big question. If the university says, okay, now you get so much APCs, so we will cut your budget with that amount, and then you have only expanded the bureaucracy. But if that means that the universities put more money into the journals, then you can expand the activities and the quality of the journals. So it's all about getting the attention of the top brass and make them understand that they need to put more money into this to make it work. And Kappel & Damm has journals that are totally APC funded, so it's a possibility.
We try to tell that some of our journals should have APCs because they're owned by the editorial board and they need income. And I'm not talking about 10,000 euro or whatever, but really small amounts, just to give them just that little extra to make it easier for them to administer their journals and even to buy help from companies like yours. But it seems like it's so new for them. The sheer idea is that they don't want to do it because they then think we'll end up like Elsevier or something like that. But they really don't want to catch up with the idea. It is an issue we have with several editors, actually.
And I didn't mean to suggest that APC is the only solution. Better financing is the idea.
So perhaps the big challenge is that some university leaders thought that when open access comes, everything will be free. But there is no free lunch. It costs money, and it's important for the university leaders to understand that publishing will cost, and open access will probably cost more than the old model because more things are being published. And then when libraries work with publishing, is that work really rooted with the university leaders? In your institution, do you get support from the top of the university?
We do get support because they're trying to build a research culture and they're trying to build some publishing. They don't, they haven't increased our budget, but they are very encouraging of the activities and operations that we're doing.
Esther?
Well, I know the university leadership of all who wants us to do it. But that's encouragement and part of our functions for them. Yeah. Don't pay extra for it.
Yeah, that's we take up a new service, but we don't get extra money. So that only means that we have less money to use to the other services. Is that the situation?
Yes, that's roughly what happens, and that's just what the ministry says to the institutions when we complain about we have got new things to do, and it's in your budget. Mm-hmm. I mean, you have to household with your money and prioritize.
Again, I'm speaking out of turn because I haven't studied my own work in a while, but I was looking at Bio1 as a funding model, and somehow the societies, the publisher, and Bio1 kind of circulated the funding around so that everybody got money at one time. And just moving that money around made it viable somehow. When I was looking at the numbers, it seemed like it was just a recirculating. It wasn't like there was creation of funding or something, but somehow Bio1 would give money back to the society. The society would give a little bit of money to the publisher, and the publisher would do part of the work, like you were saying. They didn't do everything. The society did some of the publishing work, the publisher did other parts, and Bio1 was somehow funneling this money back and forth and around in a circle that made it viable. So beyond that, I don't remember the details, but it was interesting.
Well, I would just comment on that, because we have some journals that have APC funding. And I would say the problem with the model, that model today, is that the situation for the different researchers are so different. So you have researchers that can publish articles with APCs, and you have researchers that really have problems getting funded. And I think that goes for books and that goes for journals, and it's a problem in Norway and more on a Nordic level, I think. And I don't think this is a huge problem that I think we should also address more, because we have a good projects coming in, and the researchers are working so hard to try to find any way of getting some little small funding, and then we have others who can, you know, come in with projects every year almost because they have so much funding on their institution. And I don't think that is not the system we would want for scholarly publishing. So I think we need to see also when we see that more and more scholarly publishing is going to be open access, and they're talking about making it also a demand for open access publishing on books on books and monographs and anthologies, then we need to be sure that we don't continue with this system where the researchers, a lot of researchers cannot participate. Mm-hmm. Even though they have high quality, and also that they use so much time trying to find money, and so we need to find another financing model.
That was, in a way, the reason behind the establishing of the special interest group on library publishing. That was Reggie from South Africa on a meeting on discussing open access, where he said that it's very nice that we in Africa will be able to read what you write about us. But with APCs, we will never have the chance to publish ourselves, because the Global South doesn't have those resources as you have. So he said we'll have to take responsibility for publishing ourselves. Jan Erik, you are not only advocating for open access, but you are also taking part in the work implementing Plan S in the Norwegian Higher Education Federation. They speak of green and gold open access, but do they speak about diamond open access?
No, they talk very little about it, and it's actually a problem with Plan S that the thinking is the big deals and the publishers in the big deals, because they have super profit and they are big. Humanities, social sciences, a lot of small journals, small publishers, no money. They're out of focus for the Plan S people. Mm. That's one of the reasons we wrote that article, that we saw that they were thinking of a world that was quite different from what the map actually showed. Yeah. Because most of the people in the Plan S come from the medicine and hard sciences. And so they didn't know much about the world outside that. And they say, I've experienced over the years that all scholars believe that the way they publish is the way the world works. So it's a symptom of that.
We have discussed now problems concerning library publishing for 40 minutes. We have 20 minutes left. I don't know whether there is some comments from the audience. Yeah. Jane?
Just to say about the funding model that you mentioned, the sort of advocacy role of the SIG, and I have a personal experience of that, because after we had the SIG in Dublin, Digital Commons was present there and they made a presentation. So they were visiting Dublin again, and I asked them would they call to CCT College, and the president actually made an investment in the digital commons platform. Just taking Sue-Ann's point there, that it was actually a cheaper model for us than having support, say, for DSpace. So in actual fact, suddenly we had a budget for library publishing. He also bought the library publishing platform. So certainly in terms of growing our budgets institutionally, perhaps the SIG is helpful, particularly for smaller organisations like us. But I just wanted to ask a question, Lars, if it was okay, to the panel members. Do you have library publishing groups as part of your national library associations? Because I also think that's another form of powerful advocacy to grow a resource base, to even get more recognition for this area within the library field.
Yeah. To that question, I can answer for Norway as a vice president in the Norwegian Library Association. We don't have, but we will know. We'll establish one.
I think a no from here as well.
We have the Library Publishing Coalition in the United States. They're worldwide, but so there's that group. And then we have the American Association of University Publishers and the Society for Scholarly Publishing. Those are more for commercial, but we're invited. I'm a member of those.
Could I come with some statements and just to see if we agree that universities need to take a more active role in publication, not to replace commercial publishers, but to complete. Could we agree on that? Yeah.
Well, I think that we need to discuss it much more in terms of what are you saying?
Yeah.
Because this is we are today having some kind of, I think, relationship between the publishers and the library publishing service. And I'm completely agree that libraries and higher education institutions are publishing a lot of material already. So I totally agree on that. But then what kind of services would you need to build up? And what would that be? So I think it's difficult to say, to comment on I don't know the content yet.
Yeah.
I think it's difficult to comment on a phrase like
yeah,
but because I don't know what you are planning.
Because we are having your own tape.
No, I don't know what kind of services you would like to build. Yeah.
But in Norway, we have 100 open access journals. More than 50% of them are published by universities. Imagine that the universities shouldn't publish any journals. Would those 50 journals be... Is it possible to think that those journals would be published by other publishing houses? Or would the situation be that they wouldn't be there? They wouldn't be published. Would we lose something then?
I think in the situation today, if there are no more money for the journals, so they have some of the journals that we are talking with that want more professional services, they have absolutely no money and no funding from anybody.
Mm-hmm.
So we can't afford to publish them because they have no money. And the libraries have some public funding that makes it possible for them to give a low-scale service.
Mm-hmm.
So if the libraries stop with that, those journals will have nowhere to go if there are no more money into the system.
Mm-hmm.
So I think that is really the situation, and the libraries are doing an important job for those journals now. But if there are more money into the system, and as the libraries also want, we need more funding to give better services to these journals, well, then maybe some of the journals, I don't know if all of the journals, could have some funding that would make it possible for them to choose a professional publisher if they wanted to. So I think we have been developing our services. That is more costly than when you have upscaled, you have more journals. So of course we can provide over time better and cheaper services for the journals. So that was my point on, I don't think this only as a publisher, but I think the researchers, the authors, the journal editors, they are missing in the conversation. And I think that they also have a say in how do we want the funding to be, and where do we want to publish our journal or our book. And I think we must work together on finding viable, not too expensive solutions for funding open access in Norway, but also find ways to advocate for the journals that are underfinanced.
So another statement which we perhaps can agree upon is that we need more money in the system. But I mean, everybody demands more money. But it's in a way logical that industrial products are getting cheaper and cheaper, and that the main drive in the economy is knowledge. So you shouldn't be surprised that knowledge has a higher price than the industrial products. So, I mean, when we are getting 2.5% raise in our budget, because that's the price raise. PCs, they have the same price every year, but buying journals raises perhaps 10-15%. We need more money into the system. Everyone agree.
Just to follow up on that, just remember that every cost associated with producing an article is manpower, and manpower becomes more and more expensive.
Yeah. But if the universities has to take more responsibility for publishing, is there any other option than to look for the for services from the libraries? Is it natural in the university that the libraries take the responsibility for publishing?
Well, there are other models like Archive for physics and computing science and so forth, and other models like that, BioArchive and so on, the preprint servers. I mean, other solutions are cropping up, and maybe we need to incorporate that into our discussion as well.
Yeah. Yeah, so the alternative to libraries could be archives, but that's almost the same. Anyway,
do you know what I mean, archive?
Yeah. Mm-hmm. And the future.
There is something perverse going on in the conversation. Coming back to Marcus's point, which is that libraries are not talking to their publishing house about open access. And the fact is that libraries, who's part of the dialogue, the biggest publishers with whom we spend the most money, coming back to them, this is logical, this is where so much of our money is going. So we keep talking to them about, you know, how can we reduce prices, convert to open access, publish free, reader publish transform, whatever. So libraries are doing this, and I say this as somebody who's worked with library consortia for a number of years. We direct our energy where our money is going and where our resources are. So we do that quite well. On the other hand, libraries are reacting internally by becoming producers of information in some way, whether it's repositories or some more formal publishing.
But to me, it seems people who are left out of the discourse are the ones in small to mid-sized publishing houses, which we see shifting over the years their publishing contracts to the biggest publishers so that they can have some visibility and so we can have conversations with them. Now, this is a little bit perverse, isn't it? That we leave out kind of publishing institutions, whether in universities or small independent publishers, that we could actually make. But we don't do that. I wonder why.
Yeah. Do anybody want to comment on that? No. We have. So, there was a question there.
So I just want to follow up because I think it's interesting. Another aspect of this is that after Plan S and the start, we are going into more and more big deals with the big publishers, which includes open access publishing, which means that authors from our universities can publish open access in Elsevier and Springer, etc., without having to apply for money to publish. So I think this really puts the traditional open access publishers in a disadvantage, where like PLOS and others, where the researchers actually have to find money to publish. So I think the reason that open access actually is getting more and more expensive compared to traditional publishing or as it was before is that we are going into more and more big deals including open access and
Yeah.
A comment on that. I totally agree, and it's kind of fascinating that we are now making read and publish deals that makes it zero expense for our authors to publish in expensive open access options instead of forcing them to use the inexpensive open access option in the true open access publishers and open access journals, which is, we know it's much cheaper to publish in the open access journal than in hybrid, and hybrid is no free for our authors. Not for us.
And I think because the main costs we use for these big deals, and that makes library publishing so important because we need to have some alternatives. Doesn't have to be, everything shall not be published by the library, but it's important that we have some system where a library can publish in addition to the other business models. But if we then, in the last few minutes, should think forward 1 year, what should we do? What will happen with open access and library publishing the next year? An optimistic view.
The optimistic view from the small country. I think that it's really going to advance in Ireland. Yeah. I think that that already we've got small seeds around the place. Everybody's come to the table. The universities, they're publicly funded. There's an interest within them in really getting into this area. So I think we're going to see a lot more journals and a lot more more text. Yeah, I think it's going to advance a lot now.
I also expect that we will grow, but not as rapid as we've done years before, because I think the journals that cannot survive with the public, with the private companies. And then we'll look into e-books, PhD theses and things that we would not be able to publish privately. So we will grow as well, but more slowly.
Yeah.
Well, I think there were really interesting comments from you. And so I think my point of view would be that I hope this is the start of a dialogue, and also that we will have more dialogue between the libraries and the open access publishers, and maybe that there can be possibilities for cooperations or of working together on some level. So, yeah, I think that would be my point.
I think I know, and I hope that we are in Norway working to get big deals with open access publishers. We could also need some small deals with some smaller open access publishers. We in Norway, we will be a Plan S country come January 1st, and we need to work with all open access journals to ensure that they will be Plan S compliant so that our authors can actually are allowed to publish in them. I mean, if you're not allowed, it doesn't help if you come with a million. So that is work we will have to do.
A takeaway for me from this conversation is the small to mid-sized publishers are a group that we can probably work with, whereas the large publishers were going to be in the one down position. This is an opportunity for us to maybe really build a publishing community that serves everybody's needs and considers economies and all of that.
Yeah. Okay. Thank you very much to the panel. I think. Yeah, give them an applause. This is about open access worldwide, but some of the discussion in Norway is that Norway want to be world champion in open access, but we haven't done the. Then you will have to be the national champion too, and we have a lot of work to do nationally to make sure that journals and books are open access in Norway before we buy open access from abroad. And I think that the wider heaven of our work is the UN sustainable goals, which we all shall work for to implement. And one of the main goals is to reduce world inequality, and inequality to access to information is, and we know that as librarians, inequality in access to information is perhaps the mother of all the other inequalities, and that's our big aim, to give right access to everyone, and open access is one way that we can submit to that. Thank you for coming to Norway, and have a safe travel home, and hope to see you in Dublin and in the next mid meeting. Thank you.